Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Tuesday, November the 25th. Today, spend now and pay later, the government's £20 billion package to drag Britain out of recession.
I think people are very nervous and people are avoiding any unnecessary expenditure. So it could be that the reduction in VAT is quite an expensive, damp squib.
But do Alistair Darling's plans to tax the rich signal the end of New Labour? We ask columnist Jonathan Friedland.
That defining difference between today's Labour and the Labour parties of old has now gone.
In other news, in elections in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez loses some key regional strongholds.
The opposition have made some key gains in urban areas, especially Caracas.
And how the many problems facing Africa mask some of the success stories of the continent.
On the whole, Africa is doing a lot better than it once did, and it's wrong to try and or to appear to portray this as a continent in constant crisis.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Opposition parties are criticising the government's pre-budget report unveiled yesterday. The Conservatives are calling for a full parliamentary debate on what's being described as a £20 billion gamble for Labour. Yesterday, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Alistair Darling, presented a spend now, pay later package of tax cuts and spending increases designed to lift the economy out of recession by next summer. The Chancellor said in his pre-budget report that he would borrow £78 billion this year and £118 billion next year to fund a 13-month VAT holiday, cuts in income tax, more generous payments to pensioners and parents, and a £3 billion boost to infrastructure. The Liberal Democrats said the measures don't go far enough. In the United States, President-elect Barack Obama is promising an extraordinary multi-billion dollar economic package to deliver a jolt to the American economy in order to avert what he described as a crisis of historic proportions. Mr. Obama introduced his new economic team of Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary and Larry Summers as his White House economics advisor. When asked about speculation that his package will cost between $700 billion to $1 trillion, Mr. Obama declined to put a figure on it. He said it was necessary not only to have a thriving Wall Street, but a thriving Main Street too. Today, new laws to stop women being forced into marriage and protect those already married against their will come into force. Under the legislation, courts have the power to stop forced marriages. A protection order can be made to protect people at risk of being forced into a marriage. Courts will be able to order people to hand over passports, reveal the whereabouts of a person thought to be at risk, and stop someone from being taken abroad. Anyone failing to comply with an order could face jail. A victim, friend, or the police can apply to the court for an order. In the United States' largest terrorism financing trial since the September the 11th attacks, a Muslim charity and five of its former leaders have been convicted of 108 charges. The Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development was once the largest US-based Muslim charity. Holy Land's accused of giving more than $12 million to support the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The group was designated by the government as a terrorist organization in 1995. US Attorney Richard Roper said the verdict attacks terrorism at its core. Lawyers for the defendants said an appeal is planned. Finally, British television talent dominated the International Emmy Awards held in New York last night. Brits scooped up 7 of the 10 awards. Winners include David Suchet, who won Best Actor for his portrayal of Robert Maxwell in the biography series Maxwell. Lucy Cohu won Best Actress honours for her role in the true life drama Forgiven. The BBC children's show Shaun the Sheep, the drama Life on Mars, and Channel 4's comedy show The IT Crowd also took home Emmys. The other winners were Strictly Bolshoi for arts programming and the Beckoning Silence documentary. Now look at the headlines. The pre-budget report dominates all the front pages. The Daily Mail declares yesterday's government tax as the day New Labour died, while the Daily Telegraph describes it as a middle-class tax time bomb. The Daily Mirror portrays Gordon Brown as the gambler, while The Times features a communist caricature of the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer under the headline Into the Red. The Sun warns the pre-budget report measures will bring the country up to arrears with $1 trillion of debt. And The Independent follows a similar theme with its headline Brown Goes for Broke. The Financial Times takes a less emotive line, saying the pre-budget tax hit will fund a £20 billion boost. Those are the headlines today. More news updated through the day on guardian.co.uk.
Those with the highest incomes have seen their earnings almost double since 1996. So again, from April 2011, I intend only on income over £150,000 to introduce a new rate of income tax of 45%. This higher rate of tax will only affect the 1%, the top 1% of incomes. I also intend to withdraw the long-standing anomaly of the income tax system by which the personal allowance is worth twice as much to higher rate than basic rate taxpayers. And again, I will protect those on middle incomes, and this will only affect those earning over £100,000. That's the top 2%.
Going down VAT from 17.5% to 15%, but going up are taxes on petrol, alcohol and tobacco, national insurance, the top rate of income tax from the first time since 1979, and borrowing to a whopping £118 billion next year. Ruth Sunderland, the Observer's business editor, says that most of the jaw-dropping details of yesterday's pre-budget report were leaked in advance.
There were extraordinarily well-informed leaks. I mean, on Saturday we learned about the cut in VAT, and on Monday morning when we picked up our copy of The Guardian, we learned about the new higher rate of income tax on high earners. So a lot of the provisions were very well leaked. I mean, there were a couple of little things, I think, that perhaps the Chancellor didn't want us to pay such attention to. One was the savings gateway account that he talked about for less well-off people. And for every pound these people save, they'll get 50 pence back. Well, what he didn't say was actually in previous versions of this scheme that were mooted, the idea was that for every pound they saved, they got a pound added on from the government. So actually that's a reduction in what was offered previously. A rather bigger and more important thing to a lot of people that wasn't very well trailed was, of course, the increase in national insurance contributions for employers and employees, which is coming down the line. And I think Alistair Darling may have been hoping that we're all so preoccupied with the VAT reduction and the higher earners tax, the 45%, that we perhaps didn't notice that quite so much. That will actually be a very big deal for middle income earners and for employers. So there were a couple of things in there.
In the weeks leading up to the pre-budget report, there was a lot of discussion about how the government was going to pay for any tax cuts. Do Alistair Darling's sums add up?
There are a number of ways in which he is looking to bring the books into balance. The measure that he's taken in increasing taxes for the new 45% rate for people earning over £150,000, that will affect a relatively small number of people and will only bring in a relatively small amount of revenue, so that'll only be between £1 and £2 billion. He's also increasing tax on cigarettes, alcohol and petrol, so that will pay for some of the VAT reduction. I think the big gamble that he's taking really is he's talking about bringing the books back into balance by 2015, and the measures that he's taking to get the money back through national insurance, etc., are kicking in from about 2011 onwards. So the danger with that is that we could be facing a scenario where, just as the economy is coming out and beginning to recover, that businesses and people are hit with tax increases at just the wrong time and that we're sent backwards again. So I think that's the big question, is has he got his timing right?
What happens if the VAT cut doesn't entice consumers back into the shops for a spending splurge before Christmas?
Well, you know, there are a number of issues around this VAT cut. I mean, the most obvious one is that if you're like me and you've been wandering around the high streets, you know, pondering your Christmas shopping, you can't help but notice there are huge amounts of sales going on as it is. Now, if 20% off or 50% off isn't going to encourage you to part with your money because you're too worried about your job, then clearly a fairly small reduction in VAT isn't going to encourage you either. I think, you know, the other question is, will retailers actually pass the cut on? You know, Alistair Darling said he hopes they will, but there's no guarantee that they will. I think people are very nervous and people are avoiding any unnecessary expenditure. So it could be that the reduction in VAT is quite an expensive damp squib.
Ruth Sunderland. Well, a new top rate of income tax for those who earn more than £150,000. Jonathan Freeland says that changes the political landscape.
In some ways, it's a great step backward, as if we've returned in a kind of life on Mars style to politics as it was almost in the 1970s, where you've got the old battle lines drawn. People would say that Alistair Darling, by promising to raise the top rate of tax, in some ways gave the last rites to New Labour, because that was the signature, if some ways defining, aspect of New Labour. Tony Blair giving that handwritten promise, we will not put up the top rates of income tax. And that was a way of saying, I'm not like the old Labour leaders of the past. We will not be like the Labour governments of the past. And Labour have stuck to that for 11 years. And by breaking that, yes, it did leak out over the weekend. In some ways, that muted the impact. But that is such a huge deal, because it says that that defining difference between today's Labour and the Labour parties of old has now gone. And it therefore immediately enabled George Osborne for the Tories yesterday to give an attack which was really the kind of attack Tories have wanted to make for 15 years but not been able to, which is to say all Labour governments in the end make a mess of things. They always end up borrowing. And so he was able, as if he was suddenly running against Dennis Healey, which is how Tories have wanted to do it and not been able to for a very long time, simply because of that one burial of the idea that Labour will tax the rich, as the old 1970s slogan would put it.
What's made it possible for Labour to suddenly tear up the sort of article of faith for New Labour and begin to raise the top rate of income tax?
It's the same thing that's enabled them to tear up every other rule book, including old Gordon Brown's sort of fiscal rules about the only borrow to invest, etc. And that is a global economic crisis, or at least that's crucial to their argument, is to say these are circumstances no one could have predicted and that are no fault of ours. This is just a global worldwide trend. He repeated it in the speech yesterday, Darling saying, this problem, even the Americans admit, he said, started in America, not our fault. But it's meant that everything's upside down and the old rules no longer apply. We've got such a serious recession that we can really do whatever it takes to make it shallower and less sharp and briefer than otherwise it would be.
And action announced by Barack Obama yesterday and at the weekend makes it even more easy for Labour to change direction in this way.
I think the Obama presidency is still incoming, changes and gives a lot of political cover to the Labour government, because a whole lot of things that would have once been taboo, suddenly you can say, well, not only this very popular figure, but specifically an American president, in other words, the head of the world's most capitalist country, he's doing it, therefore you can't accuse us of being some old pinko socialists. Even though he hasn't yet done this, his election campaign promised that, yes, it would make sure that the bottom 95% would see no increases in tax. Therefore, by implication, Obama's election promise was that the top 5% may well pay more in income tax. Now, the proposal that came from Alistair Darling yesterday was only really for the top 1% or 2%, but he's now got political cover. He can just say, well, you know, if you've got a problem with what I'm doing, talk to Barack Obama. He's doing the same thing. I think this may happen in a whole lot of areas of progressive politics where, of all people, the President of the United States gives cover for a British Labour Party.
And the Conservatives revived not a campaign of the 1970s, but a campaign of the 1990s with their tax bombshell, warning that Labour are going to have to raise taxes in the future. But actually, this bombshell's timed to go off after the next election.
That's right. And that's why I don't think they can play the sort of stealth card and say that, which was crucial in the 92 campaign, that there were hidden taxes. You don't know what you're letting yourself in for. Alistair Darling, I think, tried very hard to see off that point by saying, here's the small print in large print. Here it is. Here's what I'm going to do. And then to say, but don't worry, you won't feel the pain yet. Now, that's a really unusual political gamble, because what he's saying there is, you know, now that you know there's no deception involved, vote for me anyway, because you know what you'll be getting. But is there an example? You have to work hard to find an example of a government, a party, being elected, promising overtly and explicitly higher taxes. It is quite unusual. There are the odd examples, but it's a very unusual gamble. And it's particularly a pointed gamble for Labour, because they won three times by doing the very opposite and promising to keep income tax at the same level. So they're taking a huge risk here. It's not just that top rate on people over 150, earning over 150,000. In a way, the politics of that should play quite well, because you can easily spin that and say that's the super rich and the bankers, the evil bankers who got us into this mess. What about that rise in national insurance, 0.5%? That's going to affect everybody. Even actually anyone over earning over 40,000 is going to pay, it's only £156 per year, which for people in that bracket shouldn't feel like too much. But it enables the Tories to say everybody, including middle Englanders, middle Britainers, people over 45, earning over 40,000 are going to pay more. For a political party to go into an election with that around their neck, that's a huge gamble.
Jonathan Friedland. Alistair Darling's cut in the rate of VAT from 17.5% to 15% comes into effect on Monday. How will shoppers and shopkeepers respond? Martin Wainwright attempted to find out in Leeds.
I'm in hip, and it's men's clothing?
Yeah. Men's wear, yeah.
Good. The VAT reduction, what are you going to be doing?
Well, we can't reduce price at the moment because obviously we've already paid and bought our stock, and also the stock that's due to be paid is going to be on the 17.5%. So it'd be from any new stock we get in, the new VAT rate we could obviously reduce.
Well, obviously, if there's a couple of pound off in this time of the year, then it's going to help out.
I think if I can't afford it, I can't afford it.
Yes.
£10 off an item, you think,
2%, it's nothing. But Debenhams, the 25% off from 30 is very good.
Yes.
Some of the things, yes.
So that really is you know, more important than the 2%.
Is, definitely.
I think a 2.5% reduction in VAT really isn't going to make an awful lot of difference to most people.
Very interesting you said that, because that does seem to be the general view, especially with all these, you know, huge discounts advertised everywhere, which are much more than that.
Yes. Well, it doesn't surprise me that that is the general view, because 2.5% of a £100 purchase on the VAT, what's it come to? Less than a pound, probably, does it?
I'm not sure. I don't think the shops will pass on that 2.5% to the customers.
It would make a difference, though, if prices did come down. Yeah, of course it would make a difference.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Well, the FTSE 100 index soared yesterday following Mr. Darling's announcement. It was the biggest one-day rise in its history. You can see the latest share prices, and there's full coverage of the pre-budget report at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on the Guardian's website today, what does the pre-budget report mean for your finances? Our experts will answer your questions from midday at guardian.co.uk/money. Richard Williams says that the Vatican, by pardoning John Lennon for comments that he made in 1966, misses the point that the Beatle was making about religion. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And Hadley Freeman on the new fashion brat pack of celebrity offspring. guardian.co.uk/g2. In regional elections in Venezuela at the weekend, the opposition scored some important victories. They've hit the plans of Hugo Chavez to extend his dominance after 10 years as Venezuela's president. For The Guardian, Rory Carroll is in Caracas. He says Chavez has been given a bit of a bloody nose.
The opposition have made some key gains in urban areas, especially Caracas, and they've basically been able to claw back some political space that had almost evaporated over the last couple of years.
And yet, Hugo Chavez has hailed these results as a great victory for his party.
And in a sense, he is. I mean, both sides can legitimately claim some element of victory. Chavez has won 17 out of 22 states that were up for grabs, mostly in rural areas. And after 10 years in power, that's no small feat for any government. However, the opposition have won the most populous and the most economically important states. And especially in the heart of Caracas, what we've now seen is that increasingly in Venezuela, instead of an old kind of, you know, poor people supporting Chavez and rich people supporting the opposition, increasingly we're seeing an urban-rural divide, and it's city dwellers, including the poor city dwellers, and are increasingly fed up with the government and service delivery, especially over crime, inflation, and just poor public services, whereas rural areas remain bastions of loyalty.
How will this election result affect Chavez's plans to extend the time an individual might serve as president?
Well, it's still not quite clear, because what was really the reason these elections mattered so much is that Chavez is hoping to use them as a springboard to change the constitution through a referendum to allow him to run again and to basically abolish presidential term limits. Now, with both sides claiming victory here today, it's not quite clear what's going to happen next. It's going to be a tussle now between Chavez and the opposition to take the initiative. And certainly Chavez has claimed that he has a mandate now to take things forward, to deepen his socialist revolution. But the opposition, meantime, now have a lot more to play for. They have now controlling Caracas, a lot of key municipalities and slums, which used to be loyal to Chavez. So basically it's going to be fascinating. And we don't know really whether Chavez will be able to build on this or not.
Here in the capitalist Europe, Rory, we're all gripped by the pre-budget report. But how is the credit crunch affecting Venezuela? Because the falling price of oil presumably might affect Chavez's political fortunes.
Yes, so far it hasn't, because the fall in oil prices has yet to filter through to the Venezuelan economy. But certainly next year what's going to happen is that the free spending ways of the Chavez government, and here they've basically tripled the state budget over the past few years, that is going to have to end, and Chavez will no longer be able to throw money at foreign allies as well as here. And for example, we just seen in this election a real free spending way whereby Chavista candidates were giving fridges, cookers, mattresses, beds, fans, and thousands of them away to people, and this is in the run-up to the vote. Now from next year onwards, I think that Chavez will have much more will find that much more difficult to do, just because there'll be far less money here because of the oil price tumble.
Rory Carroll reporting. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Friends of the Earth tell us why forests should be kept out of carbon trading markets.
In the absence of secure land rights for indigenous people and other forest-dependent communities, there are no guarantees that local communities will benefit.
But first, the problems facing Africa are complex and numerous. Refugees, hunger, disease, insurgents, even pirates. In his column in today's Guardian, foreign affairs specialist Simon Tisdall argues that the West has a short attention span on Africa.
Well, it seems to me, as a long-time observer of these affairs, that the speed at which events are being reported is obviously accelerating at a time of sort of 24/7 global reach media. And that the media's need for a new story, a new sensation, is also ever more intense. And Africa is kind of still a bit of a wild frontier compared with Europe or the United States in terms of extraordinary happenings. And a whole succession of stories coming out of Africa in the last few months have been given pretty sensational treatment, but pretty superficial treatment, I would say, too. And then the media bandwagon moves on to the next big sensation, leaving the problems very much the same as they were before, or possibly even worse.
Mark Malik Brown, the Minister for Africa, has just been to Eastern Congo and Rwanda. And the problems in that region haven't abated, have they? They've just fallen out of the headlines.
Not at all. And in some senses, they've always been there. And the media, or to some extent, some sections of the media appeared to wake up to it in September, October, when there was a big displacement of people in North Kivu. It was a bad development in a very bad situation, which has been going on for many years. So when you hear figures like 5 million dead being bandied around, that's not referring to what's happened to in the last two or three months. That's what's been happening since Congo descended into civil war about a decade ago. But despite the severity of that situation, and despite the fact that nothing much has changed, really, the media have moved on now to a much sexier story, which is this piracy off the Somali coast.
I mean, there are so many problems facing Africa, though, isn't it? It's not surprising that, the Western media sort of flits from one thing to another, and that the Western governments find it hard to develop a coherent strategy.
Well, maybe it's not surprising, but it is a bit dismaying, because actually, on the whole, Africa is doing a lot better than it once did, and it's wrong to try and or to appear to portray this as a continent in constant crisis. As Malik Brown pointed out to me, there's quite a few countries that have quite good records, notably Rwanda, which has emerged from the genocide of the 1990s, with a fairly strong economic base, and other East African countries are doing much better than they were. But the focus is always on the bad boys and the dropouts, like Zimbabwe, or as they're characterised in the West, or Sudan, or indeed Somalia. I mean, Ethiopia is another relative success story, given the famines that struck that country in the 1970s, 1980s. It's doing relatively well now.
Simon Tisdall. Proposals to include forests in carbon trading are being discussed next week at United Nations talks on climate change. And there's a new report today from Friends of the Earth, and it says that the plans will undermine the very purpose of the talks, to reduce emissions. The group's international climate coordinator, Joseph Zakun, explains why.
If we take a step back, first of all, it made sense to include forests in the climate negotiations in Bali last December, because around one-fifth of greenhouse gas emissions are caused from deforestation. But what was very concerning is that all the proposals, almost all of the proposals to reduce emissions from deforestation were around including forests and carbon markets. And this is very concerning because there is a genuine risk that all of these kind of proposals would provide a get-out-of-jail-free card to rich nations. It would allow them to buy their way out of emissions reductions, and it would create the climate regime's biggest ever loophole, and it would remove any environmental integrity from a post-2012 deal. It would mean that forests would essentially be privatized to generate carbon credit, which would then be traded on an international market and would allow rich countries and companies to buy the right to pollute. There are also lots of other concerns around both forest carbon trading and also other proposals that could develop out of the red proposals or reduced emissions from deforestation for developing countries. And that is the fact that there is no clear definition of forests. So, for example, it could include plantations. And that would mean that, for example, we could see that red proposals lead to a massive expansion of monoculture plantations, although monoculture plantations at best include 20% of the carbon that intact forests do. So Brazil's position, for example, at the moment, they're talking about net deforestation. And that probably means that they're designing forest policy to cut down trees and then replace them with monoculture tree plantations. And this would have a massive impact on biodiversity and severe negative impact on forest-dwelling communities.
Wouldn't plans to pay the owners of the world's rainforests not to cut them down help developing countries by injecting vital funds to help alleviate poverty?
Well, it really depends. I mean, it refocuses attention onto the question of who forests belong to. And in the absence of secure land rights for indigenous people and other forest-dependent communities, there are no guarantees that local communities will benefit, especially if there are no secure land rights in place. We could see how state and corporate control over land would increase, especially if the value of forests rises. And we're already seeing how in the negotiations, indigenous peoples are being marginalized from the talks, whilst these negotiations are moving at a very rapid pace.
Joseph Zakun from Friends of the Earth. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Roxanne Escobales. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.